This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, Wisconsin's Supreme Court said a member of the DNR's policy-setting board can keep his seat despite the fact that his term expired over a year ago. A WPR reporter tells us about the court's decision and what it means. Now it's Food Friday. Summer is a time of fresh fruits and veggies and a great time to eat seasonally. Seasonal eating may not only taste better, it could also be good for our health and the health of the planet. From farmers markets to foraging to gardening, there's a lot of ways to get great local produce. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite produce this time of year? Your favorite fruit or vegetable? Where do you get it? Farmers market? Forage? Your own backyard? What do you like to cook with? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Elena Terry is a chef and Ho-Chunk tribal member. She's the founder and executive director of Wild Bear Ease, a Wisconsin-based nonprofit she started to keep First Nation food traditions alive and to help community members who are dealing with trauma or addiction. Elena, welcome back to Central Time.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, I know I've talked to you in the past about seasonal foods, and I know you, like me, are pretty excited about them. Why do you enjoy seasonal cooking and eating so much?
I think here in Wisconsin, we have such a diverse amount of food that changes so significantly with the seasons that it's so nice to be able to get the bounty when it's the freshest as possible. And in summer, I mean, this is a great, very abundant time for us.
What right now is out there in Wisconsin that you're loving to work with?
We just are finishing up the last of the milkweed bud season, and that's for foraging. And that's a really big delicacy for us. And it's something that kind of marks the true beginning of summer when that season shifts. And of course, right now it's all of these fresh garden ingredients. Like, we started our gardens over a month ago. So now we're starting to see some of those fruits of our labor popping out, and it's really exciting.
Now, hang on. Milkweed buds are edible by humans? Because I'm a really good milkweed farmer. My strategy is to not pull it up when it grows because it's good for butterflies. I had no idea that these are edible, all of them?
Yeah, the milkweed is a really diverse plant, and the buds, when they're still green and tight before they start turning to the purple color, are edible. So we take the buds and the very immature leaves that surround those. And yeah, we've done everything with them, from tempura and frying them to putting them in our traditional soup.
Wow. Okay. Well, you've just blown my mind right off the bat there. What are some other things that people are surprised to learn that is, you know, maybe right in our backyard and edible?
I mean, there's so much in our backyards. One of the things that I like to show, especially the youth that we work with, are the red clovers. That it's one of those things that you see and you don't really process, that it has this incredibly sweet floral honey flavor to it. And so we like to mix that with, say, lemonade to give it a completely different twist and to add a little bit of a color to something. And it just, I think it brightens up your palate a little bit in identifying that there's those flavors out there in these incredible plants. You know, we also talk about dandelions a lot, but the incredible health benefits to those. And it's a plant that we walk past and we don't really see unless you're looking for it. I think right now, even the blueberries are coming out. And I mean, it's a very plentiful time for us.
Other berries are out there now too. I've talked to you in the past, I think, about service berries, aka June berries. They have a bunch of different names. I've been making simple syrup out of them, and I froze some for smoothies. What are some of your favorite berries that you like to work with this time of year?
Oh my gosh, every berry. We're the wild berries. No. First of all, I love hearing that you have made stuff out of them. You know, this year was the first year that I even tried making some lilac syrup, and it was incredible, because then I used that syrup to make marshmallows and to put in, like, into a cake. So I think when you see these berries, that transition, when you're able to get out and pick them, you're able to really open up a plethora of different ways to utilize them, right? You don't just have to make a syrup. You could even add, if you were making the syrup, you could add that into your favorite cocktail or drink to really boost the flavor. And it's not just the berries themselves. A lot of the times you can harvest different flowers from them and use that to incorporate it into flavoring your food. So, I mean, we just got a ton of mulberries off the trees and we made that into jam. I think the biggest thing with those is that they are very seedy. So if you need to strain them a couple times, we do that just to alleviate some of the extra texture that might be in there. We're just now starting to see the berries come out on our blackberry bushes in the backyard. So I'm really excited for those to come. And like I said, the wild blueberries are incredible. If you are able to find a patch of wild blueberries, they're so much more condensed when it comes to sweetness and flavor. It's definitely something different from what you would be able to purchase off the store. Although buying blueberries at the store isn't always terrible either.
Now, for general foraging advice, for people who didn't grow up knowing what is edible and what isn't, what is your advice to make sure we're eating stuff that that is edible?
Yeah, of course. And there is a lot of like doppelgangers and tricky parallel plants. So you want to make sure that what you're foraging, you're aware that it is what you hope. There's a lot of apps out nowadays where you can for free identify plants. And then there's some where you can pay a little extra and they'll give you all of the information, like the Latin terminology of the plant, if it's toxic or what its multiple uses could be. So I always say, if you're not familiar with it, definitely we have the resources nowadays where it's like, before I used to have my pocket, identifier book on me all the time. And now it's a little bit easier because I can just pull out my phone and see to confirm. And even with me, I do that just to make sure when I'm foraging that I'm getting the right thing, because the last thing we want to do is to take something that isn't meant for us to take, whether that's an edible food or plant or for medicinal purposes. However, if you do really want to get a little bit more in depth from what like a snapshot on an app could give you, I would say find the plant and then do a little bit deeper research. When it comes to milkweed, if you look it up, it says it's a toxic plant, and it is at different phases of the plant's lifespan, but every part of that plant is usable at some phase of its life, and it doesn't really say that on the internet. So I would say do a little deeper research if it's something that you've heard about, or, you know, just to confirm whether or not it is toxic, because some of those things might say eat it and it isn't edible, or it's based on the phase that it's at in its growth.
We're talking to Elena Terry, a chef and executive director and founder of the group Wild Berries. That's B-E-A-R-I-E-S, like Berries. It is Food Friday, and we're talking about eating with the seasons, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite food to forage in a Wisconsin summertime? Do you have a favorite crop that you like to eat this time of year? Something maybe popping up in your garden or at your local farmer's market? Join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Elena, we've been focusing on foraged food items so far. What are some of your favorite cultivated things that are popping up this time of year that you like to work with?
Oh, so we have lavender that we cultivate, and those flowers right now are incredible. And this year we've been focusing on pole beans. So they are really climbing and stretching out, but we haven't seen any of those come yet. We have planted a lot of different squash, and although we haven't seen the fruits appear, we have been able to harvest the male squash blossoms and use those, which is an incredible vessel for any kind of, like, it's so versatile. We really like to stuff it with cheese and then like roll it in some blue cornmeal and deep fry that. And it's this incredible crispy texture with a creamy inside. I mean, you know, in Wisconsin, I love cheese and I like to stuff it into stuff. Those squash blossoms are, if you have access to them, I would definitely say to try it, because it's very unique when it comes to texture and flavor, and it's really hearty, but it's also very delicate. So that's one of my favorite things to get out of the garden now too, is are harvesting those things that help us be responsible with the plants as well.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Matthew is with us in Blue Mounds. Matthew, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. A couple of things that I've been doing for years is the harvesting of the wild mushrooms, the chanterelles, the hen in the woods. Now the oyster mushrooms are still pretty prevalent, and then the chicken in the woods. And they're just out there ready to be taken and, you know, putting your culinary ideas.
And Matthew, what do you like to do with them, cooking-wise?
Well, we just discovered a new thing with the oyster mushrooms. We actually just leave the caps, and we do them on a sheet pan with oil, and we crisp them up, and they're almost like potato chips.
Oh, wow. Oven-roasted mushroom chips. I love it, Matthew. Thanks a lot. Elena, your thoughts on mushrooms?
Oh, my gosh. I love that, Matthew. Thank you for sharing that. I mean, mushrooms are incredible, and he lives in the perfect spot to go foraging for them. They are a little tricky, so it's something that you want to be able to make sure that you're identifying correctly.
Right.
And sometimes they say a cross cut will help you do that if you slice them open. But once you find what you're looking for, like, mushrooms add this incredible depth of flavor to anything you put them in. Sometimes they can be a little bit overpowering, so you have to like that flavor or get a little bit more accustomed to it. But when you add them, I mean, they're not just flavor. You can change the texture of a dish. I mean, they're incredible. I love hearing about people who are able to go into the woods and identify all the different kinds of mushrooms and find them. Those are my kinds of people.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Elena Terry, chef, founder and executive director of Wild Berries. Elena's with us to talk about cooking with the seasons, including foraging, and some great things to try in the summer months. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite bit of produce available in Wisconsin this time of year? Whether it's wild foraged or grown, let us know what you like to do with it, where you get it. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Elena Terry, a chef, founder, and executive director of Wild Berries, a Wisconsin-based nonprofit. Elena is joining us to talk about the many benefits of eating with the seasons, talking about some great gardened and foraged foods we can eat here in Wisconsin this time of year. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Elena, I want to follow up. I got the zucchini in the backyard. I got the flowers. I'd like to eat them, but I don't want to eat them if it's going to stop the zucchinis from growing. You mentioned the male blossoms. I don't know how to tell them apart.
Well, the males have a pistil inside, so they definitely look a little bit different, and you want to keep the female ones to get pollinated, and those will turn into the fruit. So if they have like the really long stem inside, those are the male ones.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Andrea is with us in Shorewood. Andrea, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
So in my garden, I love the early harvest. So if I have like young spring spinach and beet greens, if I grow too many beets, but I love my foraging is, and I only pick it out of the garden, is actually a weed, but in my mind, it's highly edible and delicious. It's called purslane, and it has a lemony citrus flavor to it. I only pick it early in the season when it is, before it's gone to seed or anything, but when my young greens are coming up. To saute it in a pan is just this, it adds this vibrant lemony citrusy flavor, and it's kind of looks like a little bit of a succulent, but mm-hmm. You can't mistake it for anything, and it's never poisonous.
Andrea, thanks a lot for sharing that. I have a purslane story. I had a patch in my yard. I was going to try to grow grass in it, and this weed took it over, and I was yanking it, and a woman in the neighborhood came by. I was like, what are you doing? Why are you throwing all that away? And she told me it was purslane, and I told her she could take all of it she wanted to. Elena, have you worked with purslane?
Yes, and it's it's a great ingredient, and it is pretty prolific in gardens. So if you have access to it, like, it does have a very unique taste and in flavor, and it does offer some brightness. I was going to say also, you know, an incredible way to appreciate your early greens and the freshness of the beginning of this season is to make a salad. I mean, I know it sounds really basic, but you can transform the flavors of a salad so significantly with what you choose to put in there and how you choose to dress it. And when you were talking about making simple syrup, that's a great way to infuse flavor into a very easy vinaigrette. So I definitely appreciate being able to do that and load up whatever's fresh and harvestable on that day into those salads.
Thanks a lot for sharing that with us, Andrea, at 800-642-1234. Brian joins us now in Kenosha. Brian, hi.
Hey, how you doing today?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Brian?
Oh, I want to talk about how much I'm looking forward to harvesting the wild black caps that are going to be coming up in the area shortly. So that's a, I think it's either an invasive or a native black raspberry growing in our area.
Okay, and then what do you do? I mean, obviously you could just eat them, but what do you do with all of them?
Well, either freeze them to preserve them for the rest of the season, or I'll make a big batch of jam and can that up. There's a bunch of different things that you could do with them. I make a really nice black raspberry salad dressing out of them. Ooh. But that's just one of my all-time favorite fruits that grows wild in this area. But there's also, we just passed the wild asparagus season, and that's one of my all-time favorite moments. Like right around Mother's Day in this area is when it popped up in all the bike trails and drain ditches by fields.
Wow. Brian, thanks a lot. So Alina, those black cap raspberries he's picking.
Oh my gosh, those are absolutely delicious. I mean, just saying black cap raspberry, it reminds me of being a kid and finding these wild bushes when we were out swimming or something, and it was like the mother load. They're really sweet and very condensed flavor. I think the best way to honor it is to add a little bit of that acid again, like a little bit of fresh lemon juice as well. I think sometimes when I've frozen them, they've gotten a little bit mustier flavor, like they deepen in their flavor. So that might be something to look out for. But I think when it comes to those, I barely get them to the freezer because they're so delicious. We'll just leave a bowl of them on the counter and my kids will eat them throughout the day.
Brian, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Elena Terry on Food Friday. Elena, what are you looking forward to now in the next couple months? Let's advance the clock a little bit. What are you watching for to pop up?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I mean, I love the corn season when fresh corn starts coming and showing up in different forms, if it is a colored corn or the sweet corn. I mean, it's just something that really comes out is summertime for me when the corn starts to be, you know, taller and plentiful. And of course, I love the squash. I know that we had mentioned beets before, and I really think beets are an underappreciated, just like golden egg that grows. You know, they're so good for you and they're very versatile. And at first I was a little intimidated by the earthy flavor of that, but I think roasting a beet with a little bit of orange juice and olive oil is incredible. They're almost like little sugar cubes of a very unique flavor. And you can eat the greens on those and saute them, which kind of brings me to this very prolific space of like collard greens and the incredible greens that come out, and they are so plentiful in the summer. You can complement those greens on any level with your fresh herbs and making sure that you are able to honor that. I mean, the other day we had some early potatoes with just fresh dill, and it was an incredible bite. I made it again the next day. It was so good. So I think just being able to be open, and I myself love finding new foods and trying them out and seeing what people are growing. So being able to go to the farmer's market or to be in community like that, where people have really put something, an investment into cultivating these foods, I think those foods just have a brighter flavor and a bigger appreciation in your household when you are able to use them. So definitely it's a very plentiful time of year, and there's a lot of diversity in our communities with what's provided. I mean, I just can't wait to see what people come up with.
Now, with corn, I got to say, I love fresh corn. I've never been really creative with it in the past. Boil it and eat it, or grill it and eat it. But lately I've started, you know, maybe roasting it and using it for a Mexican street corn, or, you know, just getting creative ways to get different flavors out of it. What is your favorite thing to do with the fresh corn?
Well, when you talk about flavor diversification or using it a little bit differently, you can grate a fresh ear of corn and it gets that corn milky, incredible. Like if you had a creamed corn, you can add that to anything. Like I use that for bread. I use that and strain it to add flavor to stock, which you can also take like your corn cob and add that to a soup stock. And it is just incredible when you include that part of the corn in, which I think a lot of people discard. I used to discard it until I found out how flavorful it was when you added it to another dish.
I'm grating the actual cob into my soup. I want to make sure I'm hearing you right. The cob itself.
Yes, yes. Wow. The cob. It try it and then we'll talk again because it's transformative. It really is a different depth of flavor and it contributes so much to the end result. I think just being able to open your mind and be willing to try different techniques with it is incredible. I mean, the corn fritter, the hush puppy, there's so much that we can talk about corn. What are you doing next week?
Let's have you back when corn is really in season. That sounds awesome.
I would love to talk corn with you.
I'm in. We'll get it on the calendar. Elena, thanks again for joining us.
Yes, thank you for having me.
That's Elena Terry, a chef, Ho-Chunk tribal member, and founder and executive director of the group Wild Berries, a nonprofit here in Wisconsin. She started in part to help keep First Nation food traditions alive. She joined us to talk about seasonal eating, what produce you can expect to find in Wisconsin this time of year and the weeks to come, grown and foraged as well. Keep sharing your favorites over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show, insects are keys to ecosystems, agriculture, and more, but there are some signs of declining populations. Check out the research and conservation efforts. That's Monday morning on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, the head of a conservative Wisconsin law firm reacts to the overturning of Roe v. Wade and the state's attorney general filing a lawsuit that challenges Wisconsin's 1849 law banning almost all abortions. Now, the state Supreme Court ruled this week that Fred Prehn can keep his seat on the policy-setting body for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Prehn was appointed by former Governor Scott Walker. His 6-year term expired last year. This week's court decision was in response to a legal challenge from Attorney General Josh Call. So why is Prehn still on the board? Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter based in Superior. Danny, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Rob.
So I walked through a bit of the story in the intro. Can you flesh it out a little more for us? So why is Prehn still on the board leading up to this lawsuit?
Well, Prehn has argued for more than a year now that there's a prior Supreme Court ruling. It's often referred to as the Thompson decision, but it was a ruling in 1964 that basically allows holdovers in office to continue serving on the board until the Republican-controlled Senate would confirm his successor. So basically, conservative justices have said that they just don't see any reason to depart from that decision, that pre-existing ruling, and they think it remains, quote, as sound today as it did when the case was first decided.
And then in the background to the story, Governor Evers has a nominee for this position, this post. What's happening there?
Yeah, so Sandy Noss is a conservationist from Ashland, or rather she taught at Ashland High School, and I think now she's in Drummond teaching. And she has more than 3 decades of conservation experience. I believe she led the Bayfield County Conservation Congress. And she's just got a really good record of qualifications in natural resources and conservation. And so Evers appointed her to the position on April 30th of last year, I believe. And since that time, you know, as we've said, Prehn has refused to step down and he's essentially blocked her from taking a seat on the board. But also, you know, the Republican controlled Senate has refused to act to confirm her.
And what did Attorney General Call argue in bringing this lawsuit?
So he basically argued that, you know, because Dr. Fred Prehn's term expired, that he was no longer protected and could be removed for any reason, not just for cause. Because basically what the Supreme Court decided in this prior Supreme Court ruling had said is that you can only be removed from a position if you die, you resign, or for cause, or basically like misconduct in office. And so he's been sitting there ever since.
Talk to Danielle Kading, WPR reporter based in Superior, looking at the Wisconsin Natural Resources Board. The state Supreme Court ruled a holdover appointment could stay on that board while a nominee of Governor Evers has not been confirmed by the Republican-led Senate. Danny, let's talk about the Natural Resources Board. Why would we care who is on it? What do they do?
Yeah, well, it's the policymaking board for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. So they decide a lot of contentious environmental policies. And in the last year, there have been several. We've seen proposed standards for so-called forever chemicals known as PFAS come before the board. We saw the contentious wolf debate come before the board as far as a wolf harvest quota for last fall's wolf hunt, which was eventually put on hold. But, you know, these are issues that Dr. Fred Prehn has said was part of the reason that he wanted to remain on the Natural Resources Board, is because of these important issues regarding wildlife and water. And in his time serving on the board, he's kind of played a deciding, he's been a deciding vote, especially with the wolf harvest quota last fall. You know, initially that vote came down 5-2, I believe, but Sharon Adams, another board member, said later that she was confused. So really it was a conservative majority of that board that decided they were going to set a harvest level of 300 wolves for the fall hunt, which went way above and beyond what the DNR had recommended, and is way beyond what environmental groups and wildlife advocacy groups wanted. And then when you saw the PFAS standards issue come up, you know, the board outright voted to reject groundwater standards that were recommended by the DNR and state health officials, and they weakened the PFAS standard for drinking water in Wisconsin. And now we've seen the US EPA under President Joe Biden come out with even more restrictive health advisory levels for these chemicals. So basically saying that whatever was in place before is not enough to protect public health. And that's what the board decided to go with as the threshold for the drinking water standards. So people are really upset about him remaining on the board, but there's also a lot of people who think that he should be there deciding these issues, especially among conservatives and business lobbyists and Republican lawmakers.
In your reporting on this, you focus on the Natural Resources Board. Is there concern that there are other unconfirmed appointees who could face similar situations or be ousted if there's a change of administration?
Yeah, I believe that Attorney General Josh Call told the Associated Press the other day that this sets a terrible precedent, that this would, in fact, have the effect of basically the Senate could just hold off on confirming any nomination that the Evers administration may have and just wait and hope that they get a Republican governor in office with the election this fall. So there's no incentive right now for the parties to work with each other. It's kind of this back and forth. And I think it's really the voters of the state who lose on this one. No matter what political party you're from, neither the administration nor Republicans are working together on this. And we should be able to have a system that works and functions, regardless of whoever has political power at the moment.
And getting back to the Natural Resources Board in particular, it sounds like this is a done deal. The highest court in the state has ruled on this. So is there, I guess, is there still any thought that this might change?
Not that I'm aware of. You know, this will probably come up on a case-by-case basis. You know, we might see it soonest with the UW Board of Regents. I believe Rebecca Clayfish and Kevin Nicholson, who are running for governor as Republicans on the ballot this fall, they have said that they would eliminate any Evers appointees and install their own political appointees to that board that's more in line with their goals for higher education. And it could come up with a number of other positions.
We'll leave it there, Danny. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
That's Danielle Kading, WPR reporter based in Superior. We talked with her about why Natural Resources Board member Fred Prehn is still serving on the board despite his term expiring over a year ago, and what it could mean for environmental policy here in the state. Coming up, we talk with the leader of a conservative Wisconsin law firm about the legal landscape for abortion seekers and providers in the state following the overturning of Roe v. Wade by the U.S. Supreme Court last week. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We heard last week that abortion appointments in Wisconsin immediately halted following the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. 4 days later, Governor Tony Evers and Attorney General Josh Call announced a lawsuit challenging Wisconsin's 1849 law banning most abortions in the state. We talked to the Attorney General here on Central Time after that announcement. Our next guest says that suit should be immediately dismissed. Rick Essenberg is president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Rick, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me.
Before we get to the lawsuit, Rick, I just wanted to get your general reaction to last Friday's big news from the U.S. Supreme Court on Roe v. Wade.
Well, you know, I wrote my law review note on Roe versus Wade back when Jimmy Carter was president. And the problem with Roe has been since the beginning that no matter what you feel about abortion rights, it's very difficult to justify the decision legally. You know, one of the great legal scholars, liberal legal scholars, really, of the time said that the problem with Roe is not that it's bad constitutional law, but it doesn't even attempt to be constitutional law. It's really more an exercise in philosophy. And so I think for 49 years, people have tried to find the legal justification for Roe that the court never provided. Nobody was able to do that. And so I think what happened last Friday was inevitable once you got a textualist, originalist majority on the court.
I want to give a listen now to Attorney General Call talking to us earlier this week, shortly after he and Governor Evers announced the lawsuit.
So today we announced a lawsuit arguing that the 19th century abortion ban is not in effect in Wisconsin, and that first, it's inconsistent with laws that were passed more recently that regulate abortion but don't prohibit it. And when there are inconsistent laws, there's a lot of court precedent for the idea that the more recently passed laws control. And then we've also argued that the disuse of the abortion ban, which has been understood to be unconstitutional for more than 50 years and was only sporadically used even before then, renders it unenforceable as well.
So we'll unpack bits and pieces of that. But big picture, Rick, as you see it, is there an abortion ban in effect in Wisconsin today?
Yes, I think there is. I think that the law, which Attorney General Call is challenging, was one of the first laws passed by the state of Wisconsin. It was passed as part of the codification of laws treating homicide right after we became a state. It has been amended a number of times over the ensuing century, generally making it a little bit stricter. And then during the period that Roe was pending, although, as Attorney General Call points out, the legislature did from time to time pass laws regulating abortion, it pointedly did not repeal this old law prohibiting abortion, reflecting a clear legislative intent that law remain on the books until such time as Roe may be overturned.
Did those laws, those later laws, specifically say that? I mean, some states have structured laws saying, you know, if and when Roe is overturned, that triggers or sunsets this law in the past. Is that in the text of those later laws?
Well, it wasn't a trigger law in the sense that a trigger law is a very different thing. It's a law in which a state that did not have a prohibition on of abortion on the books would pass a law knowing that it couldn't be enforced, but would provide that it would come into effect within, it's usually about 30 days, some period of time after Roe versus Wade is overturned. Here we had a law preceding Roe, still on the books, not enforceable because of Roe, but the legislature, despite having 49 years to repeal that law, oftentimes having a Democratic majority in both houses of the legislature and a Democratic governor, chose not to do so. And so, you know, Attorney General Call here is arguing for what is called implied repeal. That is, he wants to argue that the old law was repealed, even though the legislature never actually did it. The problem with his theory, and he's got a bigger procedural problem with his case before we even get to the substance of his theory. The problem with that theory is that courts tell us that implied repeal is strongly disfavored. It can work only in the rarest of circumstances, and it ultimately is a matter of legislative intent. But the legislature here clearly never intended to repeal the law because it pointedly did not do it. It simply passed a series of regulations that enacted those restrictions on abortion, which could be enacted while Roe was in effect. But the legislature quite clearly declined to repeal the law that Attorney General Call is now challenging.
But before moving on from that point, Attorney General Call again argued you have two laws on the books. One says abortion is illegal except in very limited circumstances. One says it's legal in a wider variety of circumstances. Isn't it worth at least the legislature going back and clarifying?
Well, one might want to have the legislature go back and clarify. One might say, for example, that the legislature should restate the old law to, you know, say, provide an exception, you know, for rape and incest. That's all a legislative determination. That's for the legislature to do. That's not for the courts. It's not for Attorney General Call. But it's not that unusual that there would be conduct that would be simultaneously prohibited by a number of different statutes. There are inconsistent or not inconsistent. There are multiple criminal prohibitions of the same conduct. And as long as they're not used in ways that violate the due process clause, they don't present a legal problem. Again, the matter is one of legislative intent. Did the legislature intend to repeal this earlier law? Quite clearly, they didn't. What they intended to do is enact whatever restrictions they could enact while Roe is in place.
Talking to Rick Essenberg, president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, looking at post-Roe v. Wade Wisconsin and the lawsuit from the state's attorney general against an 1849 law or intended to stop the implementation of an 1849 law against abortion. So we're going to call her. Steve is with us in Sun Prairie. Steve, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I do find it kind of funny that the host would talk about, you know, and I've heard it a lot from people on the left, that, you know, this law is so old. It's 150 years old, and we should not enforce it. Yet at the same time, they'll say, well, Roe has been on the books now for 50 years, so we have to support it. So it's kind of funny that at one hand, they'll say this law is too old, so we can't enforce it. But this other law is 50 years old. It's very old. We have to support that one. I just find that inconsistency in the argument pretty funny.
Steve, thanks for the call. I didn't say that the law was too old to enforce, just to clarify. But Rick, what do you make of Steve's point?
Well, I think Steve is making an excellent point about Attorney General Call's second theory of the case, and that is that we simply have to ignore the law because it hasn't been enforced in so long. Well, that's a little bit like, you know, an orphan, you know, who, you know, someone who, you know, kills their parents and then asks for the mercy of the court because they're an orphan. The reason that the law hasn't been enforced is because of a federal judicial decision which has now been overturned, Roe versus Wade. And so, you know, that tells us absolutely nothing. And I'm aware of no case law that supports the notion that because there was a statute that was in place for a long time but unenforceable because of a Supreme Court decision, that we can now ignore it once the Supreme Court has told us that that older decision was an error and has been reversed.
Thanks for the call, Steve. I want to talk about enforcement of the 1849 law, assuming that ends up being and staying in effect. It has the exemption to save the life of the mother. Some Robin Voss, Assembly Speaker, wants to add maybe some more exceptions. A couple pro-life groups want to tighten up the life of the mother exception. How do you see that being enforced under the law as it stands?
Well, I mean, the statute provides that abortion is prohibited except to save the life of the mother as certified by, you know, two physicians. So, you know, that strikes me as language that, you know, certainly is capable of administration and enforcement. I do think that there's a larger question now that Roe has been overturned, and the question of abortion regulation has now been returned to the states. And I think that what the Dobbs decision challenges us to do is to have a rational and deliberate debate, one in which we try to refrain from calling each other names or using barnyard epithets like the governor did, and say, okay, look, what do we want the law regulating abortion to look like? And it may well be, as Speaker Voss suggests, that we want a rape and incest exception, which is not in the law today. It may be that there are other things that we might be able to reach some consensus on. But what we're faced with now is a situation where, you know, the legislature and the governor are going to have to do their jobs. They're not going to be able to posture. They're not going to be able to blame somebody else. The decision has returned to them, and it is incumbent upon them now to engage in a conversation and a debate, which Roe has basically prohibited for almost 50 years, and decide exactly what the regulation of abortion in Wisconsin should look like.
One big change, of course, from 1849 until now is medication-related abortions. How do you see that fitting into the enforcement of that law, again, assuming it stays on the books?
Well, you know, it becomes a quite complicated question because, you know, I think Speaker Voss in his comments referred to Plan B or the morning after pill. As I understand the science of the matter, and, you know, as a doctor, I'm a really good lawyer, so I may have this wrong, but it's not clear that Plan B is actually an abortifacient. If it's not an abortifacient, it doesn't destroy the life of an unborn child. It wouldn't be prohibited by, you know, Section 940.04, which is the law that was enacted at the time of statehood and has been on the books ever since. There are other drugs that clearly are abortifacients that would be prohibited by the law, but then there would come into play all of these, you know, complicated questions about, well, what happens if you get these drugs prescribed by going out of state? What happens if you take them out of state? Does that violate the laws of the state of Wisconsin? Presumably it doesn't. There are going to be all these ancillary questions that, you know, law enforcement authorities and the courts are going to have to wrestle with as we go forward, and which I suppose is another reason why, you know, a restatement of law might be in order.
Rick, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you. Take care.
That's Rick Essenberg, President and General Counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. We talked to him today about his legal view on Wisconsin's legal landscape for abortion following the U.S. Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade a week ago. We also got his response to a lawsuit filed earlier this week by the Wisconsin Department of Justice challenging the state's 1849 law banning most abortions. We heard from the Attorney General about that lawsuit earlier this week. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, bald eagles are nesting in all of Wisconsin's 72 counties. We'll find out how a long-term recovery effort has brought them back and hear why they have a special meaning here in the state. That's coming up Monday here on Central Time.